We are continuing our series we've been doing. So let me just give you a little quick backlog here. We've been taking a journey through the Bible since the beginning of 2023. It's been a long journey, week at a time. We've been taking some weeks off along the way, but just trying to see our way through. The Bible, of course, means the books, because we think of the Bible as a book, but really it's a collection of books. So that's what the word means, the books. That's actually two collections of books. The first collection we often refer to as the Old Covenant writings, or the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Scriptures. And then we have the, that's the story of a nation beginning with a man, Abraham, and just way back in early Genesis all the way through God's working in that people. And then the New Covenant, or the New Testament, or the Christian Scriptures, the Christian writings, are the story of Jesus, his sacrifice for us, his life, his death, his resurrection, and the early church from there. And as we're getting there in just a couple of few months from now, we'll be there. That's coming in a few months. But we're making our way through the Hebrew story still right now. And we are in a section of Israel's history where they formed a kingdom, and then the kingdom got divided. And then from the point it got divided, we started calling these messages thrones, because it was a study of the divided kingdom. And down south in the southern kingdom of Judah, they had a continual descendants of King David sitting on the throne. But in the north, it was mayhem. I mean, it was mayhem in the north. We're talking about, assassinations. We're talking about killing royal families, genocides, and all sorts of things to take over the kingdom. And about seven kings into the north, we met Ahab and his wife Jezebel, and they were terrible people, wicked, murderous, horrible spiritually and otherwise, and just began to weaken the nation. And Ahab passed away. Ahab was killed a few weeks ago in our story, but Jezebel's still alive. Their children sit on the throne, their son, and then their son's nephew, which would be their grandson, would sit on the throne after them. But the prophets of God have warned that that family is going to come to the same demise that so many kings in Israel before them and all over the world would come to. They would eventually be taken over, assassinated, wiped out completely, because they were weakening the nation. Because as we abandon God and abandon faith, we abandon God's ways, God's best practices, it never leads down a good path. And so the nation is now weaker, and the end was coming. But in the middle of that journey, God kept raising up prophets to warn, not only for the nation, to warn the nation while they had terrible national leadership, but also to warn the kings themselves that God's there, turn to him. But they just kept pushing away. So these prophets were just so powerful. There was Elijah and Elisha and Micaiah and others we met. But Elijah and Elisha stood out amongst the prophets of this era because they weren't just prophetic, or you might even say the word clairvoyant and how people would describe it today, in their ability to see things that they weren't there to see, things from the past or the future or the present that they were not there, but God showed them what was happening. They had that ability. We saw that last week, that ability that Elisha had to know what was happening where he was not. But besides that spiritual clairvoyancy as prophets of the Lord, they also had miracle abilities to do amazing miracles. And so we're in this era. And that's where we pick up today's two stories. So let's buckle up and get through these. The first one involves Elisha continuously saving the Israelites from the king of Aram. Now, when I say the Arameans, the king of Aram is actually a conglomeration of several smaller kingdoms that formed a powerhouse together, and they had an alliance. So over the whole thing, the king was Ben-Hadad, and later would be Hazael. But there were also almost sub-kingdoms, so to speak, with kings and rulers, and they all formed this region. So Syria is in this group that we would mention. And anyhow, as the Arameans were near Israel, they were a constant threat to the nation, to the northern kingdom. There were bigger threats further away. There was the fading Egyptian empire further away. There was the up-and-coming Assyrian empire. There was the Babylonian empire later on. But right now, as far as proximity, the Arameans were the big pain in the neck close to the northern kingdom of Israel. And they would attack them often. In fact, we saw two times they tried to take over the city of Samaria, and both times they failed. And we saw a story where the king of Israel led forces against the Arameans, and Ahab, the king, died in that battle. So a lot's happening. But right now in today's story, the Arameans are trying to attack Israel. The problem is Elisha the prophet keeps spoiling all of the plans. He, again, has that spiritual clairvoyant ability from God to know what's happening, and he begins to say things like, watch out, they're coming for you. So the king would make a strategic plan, and Israel would be waiting for them. They try another plan, and they'd be waiting for them again. At some point, it's frustrating because, well, like some of us grew up with G.I. Joe, we know that knowing is half the battle. And unfortunately, they couldn't get away from sneaking up on Israel. And they're frustrated by it. And so in chapter 6 of 2 Kings, verse 11, we'll pick up the story there today if you follow along. It says, the king of Aram became very upset over this. He called his officers together and he demanded, which of you is the traitor? Who has been informing the king of Israel of my plans? He's like, we have a snake. We have a rat in the house, right? We got a turncoat. Who's the traitor? You're going to die. Verse 12, it's not us, my lord the king. One of the officers replied, Elisha the prophet tells the king of Israel even the words you speak in the privacy of your bedroom. Awkward, okay. I mean, like, it's Watergate before Watergate, right? I mean, like, he's like, the whole house is bugged, right? But there's no technology. It's spiritually bugged. And whatever you're saying and making plans for, they know what's happening in Israel. Well, that's a problem, isn't it? So it says in verse 13, go and find out where he is, the king commanded, so I can send troops to seize him. And the report came back that Elisha is at Dothan. Verse 14, so one night the king of Aram sent a great army with many chariots and horses to surround the city. This just makes me laugh. I was thinking about this throughout the last week here, preparing for today's message. Basically, Elisha seems to know what they're going to do before they do it. So their brilliant plan is to sneak up on him. This is their idea. We're going to sneak up on the guy and surround, you know, like that's going to somehow now work. But anyhow, maybe they don't care. They're just going to send enough forces. So this group, these Aramean raiders, we've met them before, they come and they gather around the city of Dothan. Can you imagine how scary that would be to see a good-sized military force waiting for you in your morning coffee? In chapter 6, verse 15, it says, when the servant of the man of God, now we don't know who this man is, he's not named. We met Gehazi last week. Gehazi has been, he had got leprosy and he's no longer in the picture here. But this is maybe a replacement person, or maybe it's just one of several people that assisted Elisha as Elisha served the kingdom of God and served as a prophet. He had helpers working for him and working with him. Well, maybe this is the only one. Maybe this is one of several. I don't know. It's not clear. But when the servant of the man of God got up early the next morning and he went outside, there were enemy troops and horses and chariots everywhere. Oh, sir, what will we do now? The young man cried to Elisha. And it's interesting, isn't it? Remember that phrase for later. What will we do now? What will we do now? Well, what can you do? I mean, if I'm a, you know, the easy answer is, did you see how many there were? There ain't nothing we can do, okay? We're in trouble. I mean, what are we going to do? Pull out our lightsabers like two young Padawans and go to town? I mean, there is no doing it. We're outnumbered. But Elisha replies in verse 16. He says, don't be afraid, Elisha told him. Don't you love it when someone tells you not to be afraid when you have a perfectly legitimate reason to be afraid? Everyone's favorite words. You need to calm down. Like Tay-Tay would say to us or something, you know? You need to calm down. You just to have that input. You know, you're just a little too worked up right now. Don't be afraid. He's like, I have a reason to be afraid. We are literally surrounded by hostiles. But Elisha says, don't be afraid. Why? Check it out. For there are more on our side than on theirs. And again, that seems ridiculous. Now, can I imagine the young servant saying, Elisha, you're a lot older than me. So you've been out of school longer and probably forgot arithmetic and such, but I'm pretty sure there are not more of us than there are of them. But then Elisha prayed in verse 17, O Lord, open his eyes and let him see. And the Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and with chariots of fire. Da, 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 da. There it is again, right? We saw that a few weeks ago. Same thing. Interesting. Because it's a reminder that there was a spiritual realm around them that we don't see, that none of us see. That's why he had to pray that God open his eyes. Now, Elisha has seen it before. Remember when Elijah, his mentor, passed away? Elijah told him, you might not see what happens next because people don't see what goes on in the spiritual realm, but if God shows it to you, it's a special sign of his plans for you. And Elisha saw something that we don't ever see. He saw Elijah taken. He didn't just see his friend leave this life and say goodbye. He saw a peek across the veil. Things that we don't, because our senses are limited to the spiritual dimension around us, right? Our three-dimensional world that we know and our limited senses as in our physical form, we don't see the spiritual realm that's all around us. People who die enter a place that we've not been yet. People who have had near-death experiences by the thousands come back and telling stories of seeing things both here that they should not be able to explain, but they saw, or seeing something spiritual that they come back with. But in this life, we don't get to see that. And yet, Elisha got a glimpse of it when Elijah went to heaven. He saw across the valley of the shadow of death. And Elisha's not afraid because he knows there's things that you and I can't see around us, but God's got it. And so Elisha says, Lord, open my servant's eyes. Now, when he says open his eyes, I know I'm being over-explanatory, but just let me make the point. His eyes weren't physically closed. He wasn't like walking around covering his eyes. His eyes were open. That's how he saw the enemy army around him. What Elisha was saying was God opened that spiritual eyes to the realm that we can't see, but I've seen, give him a glimpse into what's happening. Open his eyes. And sure enough, the host of angel armies surrounding them. Verse 18 says, as the Aramean army advanced toward him, Elisha prayed, O Lord, please make them blind. So the Lord struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Now, I don't believe they were like literally, truly, physically blind, like Helen Keller blind or something like that. I don't think that's what we're talking about here. I think what he's saying is kind of the inverse of what we just read a moment ago, right? Like when the servant had his eyes spiritually open to see the spiritual realm, what Elisha was praying was God blind them so they think they see, but they don't see clearly what's going on. Almost like put them in a trance or a subdued ability to understand their surroundings. So we can deceive them. And God did. Verse 19, then Elisha went out and told them, you've come the wrong way. This isn't the right city. Follow me and I will take you to the man you are looking for. These are not the prophets you are looking for. He says, look, and he led them to the city of Samaria. He takes them right to the capital city where all the forces, I mean, where the main army's at. Imagine how awkward it was in Samaria. Here comes the enemy army, but Elisha the prophet's leading them. You know? And so what do? You surround them. And then it says that in verse 20, as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha prayed, O Lord, now open their eyes, you know, snap them out of it, and let them see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they discovered that they were in the middle of Samaria. When the king of Israel... Verse 21, when the king of Israel saw them, he shouted to Elisha, my father, should I kill them? Should I kill them? That's our next verse there on the screen. Should I kill them? He's wondering, what should I do about, speak, Lord, your servant hears. What should I do? And God says, no. Verse 22, of course not. Of course not, Elisha replied. Do we kill prisoners of war? Give them food and drink and send them home again to their master. He's like, guys, don't kill them. I got a better idea. Feed them and send them back home with a story to tell. Because that is both terrifying and scary and embarrassing. It says, verse 23, so the king made a great feast for them and then sent them home to their master. And after that, the Aramean raiders stayed away from the land of Israel. I guess. Because again, we could have died. We just thought it was kind of weird and embarrassing and awkward. We're not going to try that ever again. Which brings us to our second story, verse 24. Sometime later, however, King Ben-Hadad of Aram mustered his entire army and besieged Samaria. Now, this is important to understand. Ben-Hadad would be the king of the whole conglomerate of nations that was called the Arameans at this point. King Ben-Hadad, he's beyond this last story. He's a much more powerful figure. He's the whole army, and they're going to go back to Samaria and try to take it over one more time. Remember, it's important, they tried twice before and failed. They fought Israel since then and killed the king, but now the king's descendants are reigning. So he says, let's go back and conquer him. But notice this time they're going to do it a little bit differently. Notice the word besieged on the screen. They're going to lay a siege. Now, I know some of you don't care about military strategy or whatever, but some of you do. So typically in warfare, your offense, your side that goes on the offense needs to be bigger than the side on the defense. Why? Because on the offensive side, you usually get more casualties on offense because the defense is kind of entrenched. They're defending their turf, so they're desperate. They're in defensive positions. You get more casualties typically on the attack. But if you bring a big enough army, you can absorb any casualties and just steamroll over the opponent. And Ben-Hadad has lost twice with a superior force, so he brings a far superior force, but this time, new strategy, not a new strategy to history, but new strategy towards this campaign. This time, they're going to surround the city, and they're going to just wait them out. If you surround the city and cut off their supply lines, people inside will eventually run out of food and means. It's going to produce desperate times in there. People begin to starve if you do it long enough. So they put an elaborate, long plan together to surround the city with soldiers at a far enough distance so no weapons can hit each other, but watching the city, guarding the city from being able to be entered or escaped from, sitting out there and you know, they could have tents set up all around for people to sleep in and eat and feast and drink. And they could take shifts and turns of being on the job and turns resting and eating and drinking and resting in the tents. It's a huge thing. It's bigger than the whole city by far. It's massive. And you could have troops back home that could come and relieve the others with a break so that people could go on home for leave. It's just a whole process that they're living the good life in this campaign while in the city they're starving to death because they can't get out and get any relief in or out of their situation. That's what's going on in the story. Verse 25, as a result, there was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head was sold for 80 pieces of silver, and a cup of dove's dung was sold for 5 pieces of silver. Now, I'm not familiar with the mathematical scales of those days and the economy. Pretty sure the point here is that worthless stuff, you probably won't find a donkey's head or dove's dung on eBay. Maybe you would on eBay, I don't know. But this is stuff that is, they're desperate, right? I mean, and they'll pay a lot of money for anything because they're starving to death. Well, not everybody. In fact, we'll see this in a minute. But no doubt the king, you know, they're going to keep the best sized reserve of the foods for the elites, right? So the people who are poorest of the city, who don't have that privilege or position or wealth, they're probably the ones starving first. So it's not equally hitting everybody. But people are starting to drop, and it's going to affect all of them at some point here as it gets worse. Verse 26 says, one day, as the king of Israel was walking along the wall of the city, a woman called to him, please help me, my lord the king. He answered, if the Lord doesn't help you, what can I do? Now, he doesn't even believe in the Lord. No matter what God has done over and over to spare this king and his father before him, they just reject that. But he is basically saying, look, don't blame me, blame God, okay? If he ain't helping you, what can I do? I have neither food from the threshing floor nor wine from the press to give you. Key words, to give you. You know, we're running low. We're sure not going to give what we have left to you. But then the king asked, and I don't know what caused him to do this. For some reason, the king just doesn't carry on. He stops. And in verse number 28, but then the king asked, what is the matter? Like, what do you need help with? This is a terrible story, folks. I'm just reading it to you. It's gruesome. She replied, this woman said to me, come on, let's eat your son today, and then we'll eat my son tomorrow. So we cooked my son and ate him. And the next day I said to her, kill your son so we can eat him. But she has hidden her son. I mean, yikes. That's just messed up to a whole level. I mean, we've heard stories of people starving so bad, or people in expeditions get trapped and they resort to cannibalism to survive. And if for some reason they survive that, they usually get mental trauma from that for the rest of their life. It's just it's a terrible thing. But let alone someone you care about, let alone a child, what would cause these women to even think of this? And for one to do that and then be mad at the other for not doing the same is a terrible, disturbing story of how the poorest of the people of the nation, of the city, were resorting to desperation and starvation. And the king, who's walking along checking things out, is traumatized. In verse 30, it says, when the king heard this, he tore his clothes in despair. And as the king walked along the wall, the people could see that he was wearing burlap under his robe next to his skin. Verse 31, may God strike me and even kill me if I don't separate Elisha's head from his shoulders this very day, the king vowed. It's very interesting because here's a man who does not believe in God, pushes away any mention of what God wants their family to do, doesn't care. But as soon as he's in trouble and God steps in, he's grateful. But then he forgets. There's no faith there. But of course, now that he's upset, we'll blame God. It's the typical temptation for those for so many in the world today who look at God as a person that doesn't exist, but also they hate him. You know, like God is not real and he's a jerk. You know, it's both. I don't know. And so he's like, I don't believe in God. I don't have any use for God, but right now I'm going to blame him for all the problems in my kingdom where we've deteriorated to this desperate point. But of course, how do you blame God? An easy target would be someone like Elisha, who represents God in his position. So he's like, I'll target Elisha because of who he is. I'm going to cut his head off today. Verse 32 says, Elisha was sitting in his house with the elders of Israel when the king sent a messenger to summon him. Interesting that the elders of Israel, by the way, are gathered around Elisha. It's like they're like, certainly God can do something, but the king doesn't care. He hasn't sought God, doesn't care. So they're all with Elisha. But before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, a murderer, referring to the king, a murderer has sent a man to cut off my head. When he arrives, shut the door, keep him out. We'll soon hear his master's steps following him. While Elisha was still saying this, the messenger arrived, and the king said, all this misery is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were waiting for the Lord in the first place. Like, you've dismissed God at every turn, but now that you're in trouble, you're tired of waiting for God? I mean, it's just a weird mindset of a faithless king in the middle of this umpteenth crisis, and he's upset. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, well, I kind of do, God is going to one more time intervene. One more time. Now, we can argue it's because he wants to save the city at this point. It's desperate. Bad things happen all the time in the world, but he's going to step in and save the city. You can argue that he's still trying one more time, like he has over and over, to reach Ahab's descendants and family before they find destruction. He's going to intervene one more time. And so in verse 1 of chapter 7, Elisha replied, listen to this message from the Lord. This is what the Lord says. By this time tomorrow, in the markets of Samaria, 6 quarts of choice flour will cost only 1 piece of silver, and 12 quarts of barley grain will cost only 1 piece of silver. That's weird. Again, I don't know the math. I don't know the scale of finances back then compared to terms. It seems to be the inverse of what we read earlier. Earlier, they were so desperate that things were expensive. But before the siege, there was a normal price point for goods. Elisha says, by this time tomorrow, we're going to have so much food here, it'll basically be like dirt cheap. We'll have so much food by tomorrow, it will cost almost nothing to buy it. Now, can we be real? Apart from some supernatural intervention, that's not probable. It'd be one thing to say, hey, give me a few months, or I'll tell you what, give us a few years to turn the economy around. We'll get the interest rates down. We'll change things in a few years. But he's saying tomorrow at this time, you're going to have all the food you want, and it will cost nothing pretty much. That's a pretty far-fetched claim by Elisha. Of course, we've seen God work before, so everyone believes, right? In fact, it says in verse 2, the officer assisting the king said to the man of God, that couldn't happen even if the Lord opened the windows of heaven. Now, this is a guy who has been there for God to work over and over. And again, he and the king push away at that. And now he's mocking. In their desperation, he's like, that's stupid. That's foolish. Like, that could, if God opened the windows of heaven, that couldn't happen. But Elisha, with that clairvoyant spiritual ability, knowing it's going to happen, says, oh, it's going to happen, and something else is going to happen too. Not necessarily as a judgment. Maybe it is. Some people think he's going to get a judgment for what he just did. Maybe not. Maybe Elisha's just saying, let me tell you something else that's going to happen since I know what's going to happen tomorrow. Elisha replied, you will see it happen with your own eyes, but you won't be able to eat any of it. You're going to see it happen, but you're not going to survive. Just a little heads up about tomorrow's details. And now we're going to finish with the story of what happens to save the day. Ready? Verse 3. This is so cool. I love this. There were 4 men with leprosy. I don't love that. But we talked about leprosy last week. Leprosy was a disease that in the day was like diseases today that are so scary. The big L, leprosy. It was not only a disease that people got and reacted to differently. Some lepers, they lived a long time, very functional lives with leprosy. Others deteriorated and died quickly. Some were very contagious, some were not. But because leprosy was often contagious, if you got a skin disease, you were put into quarantine and left alone because no one wanted to catch it. And even if you could survive it, you were often living in a place with other people with leprosy and not with families. You could come into the city and do some commerce in certain locations, but you had to practice social distancing because of your condition. So lepers tended to live on their own. They intermingled very seldom with others. And 4 men with leprosy are at the entrance of the gate of the city, and they know that they're just, everyone's starving to death, and they're not far behind. So they said to each other, why do we sit here waiting to die? Verse 4, they said, we will starve if we stay here, but with a famine in the city, we'll starve if we go back there. So we might as well go out and surrender to the Aramean army. If they let us live, so much the better, but if they kill us, we would have died anyway. Interesting, isn't it? These guys are doing something that I think is so important, and this is not my sermon today, but just let me say it. It's so interesting. They're doing what we call being a proactive versus being reactive, right? This is an interesting observation. Like proactive people say, what are my options? What's the best option? Let me do something. Reactive people in life are the people who look at all their options and say, every option's bad. Woe is me. They complain and they just do nothing but play victim to their circumstances. If you say to someone who's being reactive, what about this? Well, that's not ideal because of this reason. Okay, what about this? Well, that's not ideal for that reason. Whereas proactive people are the people who say, I don't have good options, but this is the best option, and I have the autonomy to take it. So I'm going to step out and do what I can and be active versus reactive. And so I'm going to do what I can. And this is that's a secret hack to life as a young or old person, any age. That's a secret hack to business. Be proactive, not reactive. So they're like, hey, guys, we're going to die. That's our best option. If we die there, oh, well, at least we tried. Let's go. And they went out to the camp of the Arameans, hoping for a break. Verse 5 says, at twilight, they set out for the camp of the Arameans. But when they came to the edge of the camp, no one was there. How eerie would that be? You get to the edge of the camp, it's getting dark. No one's there. You're like, So you go further, and no one's there. Like, they go into tents, and there's, like, nobody there. There's food there. There's tables of food. There's clothing, there's wealth from previous campaigns that they brought with them. There's, you know, monetary value, there's stuff. And there's a lot of it because there's a lot of tents and it was a big army, but there are no people there. It says, here's why, verse 6, for the Lord had caused the Aramean army to hear the clattering of speeding chariots and the galloping of horses and the sounds of a great army approaching. The king of Israel has hired the Hittites and the Egyptians to attack us, they cried to one another. So what they're saying is, and by the way, they're living a good life out there. They're eating, they're drinking, they're waiting to starve out the city. And every passing day and week and month that goes by, the city is weaker, and they're doing fine. They're probably intoxicated most evenings, right? In the ranks, because nothing's going to happen. Let's just drink tonight. And they're just out there partying, and all of a sudden, they're like, why have they not surrendered yet? They must be starving in there. And then they hear the sound of an army that seems to be approaching, and their thought is, oh, no. They must have snuck out some word to hire help to come rescue them. They must have made an alliance with the Egyptians or somebody who can hurt us. That's why they haven't surrendered. They're holding out hope, and now we're in trouble. And they panicked, and they're in the, whatever condition they were in that night, they went into panic mode. And the whole army, fear spreads, panic spreads. They panicked, and they ran. It says in verse number 7, they panicked and they ran into the night, abandoning their tents, their horses, their donkeys, and everything else as they fled for their lives from no one. When the men with leprosy arrived at the edge of the camp, they went into one tent after another, eating and drinking wine, and they carried off silver and gold and clothing and hid it. Can you imagine that? Oh, guys, let's eat. Hey, there's more food over here. Hey, here's some silver, here's some loot, here's some valuables they left behind. Let's take it back and hide it somewhere so that, when everyone else finds it, we have some hidden for ourselves, our little private 401k plan, So they're going to go to work and do their thing. But eventually, it's too much. So verse 9, finally they said to each other, this isn't right. This is a day of good news, and we're not sharing it with anyone. If we wait till morning, some calamity will certainly fall on us. Come on, let's go back and tell the people at the palace. So they went back to the city and told the gatekeepers what had happened. Hey, we went out to the Aramean camp, they said, and no one was there. The horses and donkeys were tethered. The tents were all in order, but there was not a single person around. And the gatekeepers shouted the news to the people of the palace. What do you do with that information? In verse 12, the king got out of bed in the middle of the night. He told his officers, I know what has happened. The Arameans know that we're starving, so they have left their camp and have hidden in the fields. They're expecting us to leave the city, and then they're going to take us alive and capture the city. The king still can't believe it's a miracle. He still doesn't believe it. He's like, it's a trap, He's convinced. But one of his officers replied in verse 13, hey, we had better go out, send out some scouts to check into this. Let them take 5 of our remaining horses. If something happens to them, it's no worse than if they stay here and die with the rest of us. So 2 chariots and horses were prepared. The king sent scouts to see what happened to the Aramean army. They went all the way to the Jordan River, following a trail of clothing and equipment that the Arameans had thrown away in their mad rush to escape. Can you imagine finding a trail of stuff? Just dump your stuff and run faster. And they just find loot all the way out of town to the Jordan River. And the scouts returned and told the king about it. Can you imagine the people in the city who've been starving finally realize the enemy's gone and all their stuff, all their valuables and all their food are filling those massive amounts of tents outside their city, and no one's there. Can you imagine how desperate the people were to get to that food? It says in verse number 16, the people of Samaria rushed out and plundered the Aramean camp. So it was true that 6 quarts of choice flour were sold for one piece of silver that day. 12 quarts of barley grain were sold for 1 piece of silver, just as the Lord had promised. Because why sell? Hey, you want to buy some stuff? Are you kidding me? There's more over here. And they just had a feast. It was the relief they needed. Now, there's one more detail and we're done with the story today. Remember that guy, the officer of the king who made fun and says, that's ridiculous. Guys, that's not going to happen. Elisha says, it's going to happen, but I also know it's not going to be a good day for you. Well, here's how his story goes down. In verse 17, the king appointed his officer to control the traffic at the gate. But he was knocked down and trampled to death as the people rushed out. Can we just say what a crummy job that was? Seriously, what a crummy job to be told, hey, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go and stand outside the gate, and as people charge out, I want you to, keep them orderly. They're starving, okay? It's insane, I'd hate to be the guy at the doors. The people are charging, we're going to open the gate. Everyone come out peacefully, orderly, one at a time, no rush. Just make your way to the tents. There's no hurry. And all the people are hearing is, charge, cram. This is the last helicopter out of Vietnam, I mean, they're just getting ready to charge out of the city like crazy people. And so sure enough, the gates open and the guy who's trying to stand in the way, they trample him to death. So everything happened exactly as the man of God had predicted when the king came to his house. And the people were saved and the nation was saved. And guess what happens in the story that we're not going to read? The king does not come to believe in God's provision. He still decides to live the way that Ahab and Jezebel and their kids have continued to live. Terribly, murderously, vilely. And we've seen all those stories for weeks now. So we're going to stop there for today with our story. I do want to make one statement about next week. Next week, this whole narrative arc about Ahab and Jezebel and their family comes to a completion. Next week is going to be such an interesting story. I'm excited for it to be shared here next Sunday. It is about the fall of the house of Ahab, and it's going to be something else. I mean, there's a guy named Jehu who's a military genius. There are so many layers to the story on so many fronts. It's hard to keep track of it all. It's going to be a fun adventure next Sunday. But we're not going to get into that today. Today we're going to stop there, and I just want to wrap up with a few thoughts, and then we'll be done. There's no time for us to tell all the stories of the Bible in a series like this. When we made the decision to do this series like this, we had to realize that if we told every story in the Bible, we'd be doing this for years. So we skip a lot. But the reason we've done this for a while now is because we wanted, for those people who are leaning into faith but you're not sure yet, you know, you're considering it, or those who are new to faith and have never heard, or maybe the young people who don't know all the stories yet, or the older ones of us who've been around but we've not read the Bible through, like perhaps in our life, I want you to know the narrative arc of the scriptures. I want you to know the narrative story in this book, because those stories can give you not only interesting stories, but they can give you inspiration and direction in your life. Later in the Christian writings, Paul would say that these stories back here are written to be examples for us. So I want you to know the stories. That's why we're doing this whole series in the first place. But here's the deal. We don't have time to tell them all. We've had to skip so many. These stories today that we just told you, we almost skipped. I mean, there are some foundational ones you need to know. These ones were on that bubble. Like, do we need to tell these stories for this series? And we wrestled it down. And what helped us was we looked ahead, because I work with a team of us that put together and think about the messages that God puts on my heart, so that it's not just my thoughts and voice and prayer, it's their prayers and their voice. We like to have we work together on all of the stuff that is presented. And so as we looked ahead, working weeks ahead to this day and these stories, we realized that these stories, if we included them, would take place on the days that we honored our graduates. And I thought, you know what, I think I'm going to tell those stories, because there's a lesson in there that I want to pass along today for all of us, whether you're in high school still and you got a ways to go, or you're graduating this year, or you graduated recently, or you're a middle-aged person trying to figure out where your life goes from here because you're reconsidering it all. Or you're just a person trying to live day by day and walk your faith journey. And so we wanted to pass something along, and to be honest, it was difficult for us to package this one. I'm giving you a look behind the curtain that we don't normally do. But I want you to just know this before I give you my last thought. When we're developing a message, when we work at it, we have a few techniques of how we work on delivery and messages. And they don't matter. Some of you would be interested, some of you would not. But one of our techniques when we're stuck a certain way is to ask ourselves, as we package this message to present to the church, those online, those in person, either service, we ask two questions to ourselves. What do we want them to know? What do we want the audience to know? And what do we want them to do? And that sometimes helps us get clarity to some things we're trying to present a certain way. And so we did that as we looked ahead and decided on these stories. And the question came down, what do we want you to know? And it's so simple, but I thought it was right for today. And this goes for all of us today, but especially let me extra aim this to our graduates. What I want you to know today is simply this, that God's got you. That God's got you. That your ability to live in faith, that there is a God who's there and he's with you, makes all the difference in your journey, all of it. That Elisha, if you think about Elisha was a man who was not afraid when the enemy surrounded them, because he knew God had things okay, he would be okay. His servant was afraid because he didn't know it yet, but when he saw it, he was no longer afraid because he realized God's got this. He's got us. Now, the king of Israel, no matter what God did, he refused to have the faith to believe that. So he never turned to God until desperate, and he never held on to any faith. The same with the other person in the story. But we're called to faith. In fact, in the book of Hebrews, in the Christian writings, in the book of Hebrews, it says that our faith is what pleases God, and it's defined basically by saying, faith is saying, God, I believe you're there, and I believe you care. You exist, and you reward those who seek you. I believe you're there, I believe you care, you're here for me, I have faith in that. And it is our faith that gets us through. And so if I can leave you as a young age with an idea that can guide the rest of your life, not just in the macro vision, but in the daily situations you encounter, believe that God's got you. That's what I want you to know. So the question then is, what do we want you to do? And the answer is not a statement. We often give you a statement. The answer today is a question that I want you to answer for yourself. And the question is this: what would you do if you knew God's got you? What would you do? What would you do in that situation you're facing right now where you don't think God's going to help or you think you're in trouble, so you're tempted to do something that you know is not right or is unethical, but you got to do what you got to do to get by? What would you do if you knew God's got you? What would you do differently if you knew God's got you? What would you start doing that you're not doing right now if you had faith that God had it? What would you stop doing that you're attempting right now because you believe, no, God's got me? How would you approach? How would you treat your anxiety, your fears? How would it help you through the things that keep you up if you had enough faith to rest in the idea that God's got you? How would you approach those relationships? How would you approach that career? How would you approach that problem, that ethical situation, that anxious thing that troubles you, or anything else in life? What would you do differently? What would you do if you knew that God's got you? Because here's the newsflash, he does. And faith, we're called to faith. Faith is believing. The whole gospel message, the whole Christian message is so simple. That gospel means good news, right? It means good news. What's the good news? That Jesus died for our sins and was buried and rose again? Yes. That's the explanation. But bigger than that, it means that God loves you. He is love. John said he is love. Most famous verse in Scripture, for God so loved the world that he gave his son. So that when we believe that, it changes everything. Not just for later, but for now. Because we have indwelling in us the presence of God, the Spirit of God, and the peace of God that comes with knowing that he's got us. And if I can convince you in life to live a life of faith, that you are not alone, and what you decide to do next should be determined upon the basis of a foundation of faith, that God, I believe you're there, and I believe you care. What would you do if you knew God's got you? Now, I don't know the answer, but some of you know the answer right now because God's bringing something to your mind right now. You know exactly what he's talking about in your situation in this moment. And some of you need to wrestle that down this week as you pray and meditate. But for all of us, let's believe and have faith that God's got you.